What I'm thinking about here, Tomás, just looking around us this evening, is I wonder how many people here in the audience this evening at some stage in their past lives competed in the Fesh Kyo. You know, it's been running for the last 2 weeks in the RDS, and it's the most extraordinary competition. It started in 1896. They have thousands of competitors every year. And the point I always make, which I think some people seem to miss about the Fesh, is that although it produces a host of winners every year, and it also produces maybe five or six people who would go on to form careers, musical careers, and it provides a very useful springboard for them, platform, whatever you like to call it, I think it's certainly its hidden benefit, and perhaps its even greater benefit is that it produces a couple of thousand well-informed people who will form the audience in the future for the half dozen or so who go on to form careers. I think that's really important here, and the Fesh has been doing that year after year after year, and of course it's turned up some fantastic people over the years. Perhaps the most famous musical person was Count John McCormack, who won, and another very famous person who won a bronze medal, of course, but not a musically famous guy, was James Joyce. He won in 1903 or something like that. But I'm just looking around and saying to myself, I'm sure there are really good smattering people here this evening who would have competed in it, and that's really, really important, is that you have an informed audience, because look what we've got here tonight. You know, we've got absolutely, we're at the very pinnacle of classical music composition, two of the giants and two of their giant works and final works as well. I mean, Mozart's final symphony, Beethoven's final piano concerto, and it's a toss of a coin as to which I prefer. I just couldn't decide.
No, it's absolutely, I mean, we're dealing with the top quality element in all music at this point. You know, you've got Beethoven, you've got Mozart. But to me, it's like all of these things. It's like, in fact, I'm thinking of first-class growths in wine, or the best wine in the world. And one of the things about it is the best wines in the world, Lafite, Petrus, Latour, they don't need explanation. Nobody needs to tell you this is absolutely brilliant. In fact, they are so obviously brilliant that that's why I think, you know, the super wealthy absolutely love them, because they don't have to rely on a sommelier to tell them how brilliant this is. It's the same here with the music. It's the same with Shakespeare. It's this, you know, so Mozart, Shakespeare, Hemingway, Beethoven. These don't need to be explained to us as brilliant. They don't need to be explained to us as geniuses. You can see this. It's pulsing out of every element. And that's part of the genius. The part of the genius is that they are demonstratively works of such high quality that they represent, you know, peaks in human civilization.
Absolutely. I think another test of that as well, Tomás, is that you can listen to them ad infinitum and never tire of them. I mean, coming into tonight's concert here, I knew both pieces reasonably well, but I said, oh, let's listen to it and, you know, look them up on YouTube and the rest of it. I think I watched five different performances of the Beethoven, Barenboim, Brendel, Lang Lang, Ashkenazi, Rubinstein at the age of 88, playing it without a score or anything. Fantastic. And you could never tire of it. And many years ago, I had an LP of the Beethoven concerto. And I used to listen to it endlessly as well. Of course, you had to turn it over in the middle, like today. But I love that big. I love the way it takes time to start. You know, it sort of introduces and then finally gets going into. It's just wonderful. I could listen to it forever.
Did you see the Glenn Gould performance? Oh, I mean, it's quite stunning. And the way he kind of cavitates, he rotates forward and backwards as he's playing it. And that's, you know, part of the... And I was thinking, there's my Liszt kind of mesmeric element, because I was mesmerically watching him cavitate back and forward. Again, the brilliance of live performance for us.
Absolutely. He's almost watching him, there's almost a sort of an ecstatic reaction there, where he's almost in a trance-like state. And you ever notice the way he hums away to himself, and every now and then it gets a little bit loud. It's more like interference on the line than anything else, you know. But I think, you know, Barry Douglas has set himself a big challenge here. He's a very talented guy, as you know, Belfast man. He won the Tchaikovsky competition there in 1986. Fantastic. I mean, that's a major, major prize. Very significant. He's built a great career since then. But taking on both of these, and directing as well from the piano, it's a serious, serious piece of stuff to do. You mentioned there the first growth, this first growth wine, first growth music, Grand Cru wine, Grand Cru music, whatever you like to call it. Those would be some obvious choices to be drinking alongside these fantastic pieces here tonight. But anything else, Tomás, you might be thinking of?
Well, I It's interesting. You know, these are late pieces. And the minute I heard late, unfortunately, I was there with my late harvest Rieslings, you know. And these are things that you've got to wait and wait and wait. You've got to pick them when they're, you know, right at the end of their career of ripening, I suppose. And when they're reaching that moment of perfection before they fall off a cliff into sort of acetic sort of and balsamic tastes. So right at this peak. Now, I think, again, for Mozart, I don't think he was reaching a peak. I think this is a late work because he dropped dead. it's not a late work in the same way. And, of course, there's no lateness either in the Emperor, because what we have here is not something from the end of his life. It's just the last, you know, piano concerto that he did, you know. So it's not really late in that sense. But I would love to have, I would be having both of these with beautiful Schloss Johannesburg Riesling. You know, this is imperial wine. These are imperial. Both of these are beautiful imperial works. Although, I'd have to say, I did spend quite a lot of time going through all the variations. And I think that's what I really love doing now. All the possible sort of versions of performances. But then I thought, let's run back and have a look at 40 and 39. Symphony 39, 40 and 41 by Mozart, written all within the period of 7 or 8 weeks in 1788. All within this 7 or 8 week period. So, you know, a summer's work. And they are absolutely, you know, each one better than the next. Although I have to say, as a plebeian, as a Bulgarian, I really enjoy the number 40. I really do. I know it's the more popular one, and you find it on That's What I Call Classical Music 983. But I think there is some punchiness to it. And then the opening of Symphony 39 has the knock knock. Woodpecker announcement of death, you know, that is reprised in Symphony No. 5 by Beethoven. So, you know, there's connections there for us, the fifth. And I did feel that it was, you know, 41 is a character-filled, gigantic work. And obviously this is why it gets, you know, the nickname Jupiter subsequently. But it's not the best of the three. And I'd like to see, I think we should always be performing all three together. Because, and I think it was Einstein that said, these three were, you know, appeals to eternity. They're not, they're the first, you know, they're some of the most important works that he wrote, and they're not on commission.
But coming back there, Tomas, I'm thinking again, you Schloss Johannesburg and matching with it, and I was thinking, even as you spoke there, perhaps Great Champagne would be a great match here. And you know something, I was looking up there, by Barry Douglas there. You see him on Twitter, and one tweet he sent there recently, he said, looking forward to 60 hours of champagne because that's what I deserve. I'm on holiday officially. He'd have had 2 or 3 days off there at Christmas, and he was suggesting that he, you know, champagne. And I'm thinking, you know, Philippe and Claude de Gouas or a Bollinger Grand Anais or something like that. That might be the sort of thing that would really match these. This is champagne music.
It is. I mean, this is champagne music without a Grand Marc Reserve Cuvée champagne. This is Dom Perignon. This is Grand Dame. The thing is, I think we need four. You need four champagnes you need a champagne for every movement with the Mozart. And then we need something that's really going to keep giving for the Beethoven. So I think we'd have to have the Bollinger, the RD for Beethoven. That'll keep giving throughout the whole of this. I object, and I think many people object to the nicknames. Do you object to the nicknames?
I'm not so sure. I quite like these nicknames. I quite like nicknames as such, and I think the Emperor is really appropriate because this is a grand, sweeping statement. In many respects, it could almost be considered as a symphony for orchestra and piano rather than a piano concerto, because they really are given equal weight, you might say, and it's a very symphonic piece of music. It's also... It's got that great weight to it as well, obviously coming after Mozart. But I think you were beginning to see in his Symphony No. 41, the Jupiter, I think you were beginning to see the end of the classical era and looking forward into the Romantic era. You can hear, right even from the very opening bars, there's greater weight and substance and depth and even richness to the music. And it's like precursing what was coming then, what Beethoven then developed into the Romantic period, and then which developed right the way through. Remember, I was talking to you before about the whole development of
the orchestra, as the orchestra forces built and built and built all through the course of the 19th century until, I mean, it was always felt that you could always keep adding more. So we'll have, you know, we'll have six French horns. No, we'll have eight. I'll have nine or ten or whatever. Mahler, for instance, had these huge orchestras. And nobody ever thought that it was going to come to an end. But it did. And it was really the First World War that brought it to an end. Just the way it brought the whole Edwardian summer to an end, it brought an end to this constant expansion in the orchestra. But you can date it right back to the time of Beethoven, as it suddenly became much more more structured and bigger, and the sound got bigger as well.
Well, I think that's part of the explanation. I mean, one of the real problems I have with symphonic structure and with the history of symphonies is that it's very hard to explain to somebody how Mozart can have 41 and not be considered an important, you know, that symphony was not his dominant form, and Beethoven can have 9. And it be considered his, you know, his important form. There's a brilliant little scene in Ken Russell's film Mahler, where Mahler's getting off the train on his way, having completed his 9th, and he's working on the next project, and an enemy of his steps off steps off the train with him and says, "So, I mean, obviously, it's clear that, you know, great symphonic composers, 9 is their limit. How's your 10th going?" So then, on that basis, you know, at 41, it's an unusual explanation. And then, of course, you look at Haydn. But what you're looking at is exactly what you say. These are wholly different beasts. And the exhaustion of writing 9 Beethoven symphonies is quite a different matter. But that's what I look at. When I look at these three, 39, 40, and 41 by Mozart, these are symphonies that drain the artist. They are huge and soulful, and they're kicking off the Romantic era in many ways. The final movement, the Molto Allegro, is in fact, you know, to me, that's the opening bars of the Romantic period, and it's hugely and profoundly moving work. And, you know, so you can see this happening. You can see it happening in front of you. The Coriolan Overture here tonight. Sort of a great opening, and I suppose I should say, thank goodness, you know, it wasn't actually Shakespeare, but you know, it's Henrik von Collins' play, but basically it's the same story, and nobody's going to tell me that Heinrich von Collins didn't know that Shakespeare had bashed out an old a tune along the same theme. I don't think so. So, and in fact, when I'm listening to it, I suppose this was one of the first overtures that we've had the whole season that I was thanking goodness and gods, Jupiter indeed, that we weren't going to have follow this up with a play. So this was great to have an overture that was just an overture. And it's a really effective summary. I have never seen Heinrich von Collins's work, but it's a really effective summary of Shakespeare's. And, you know, it has that menacing militarism, and it has that, you know, sort of the brooding introspection, and it has the final undoing, you know, the little sort of the reversal in the life of Coriolanus. So it's a super choice, and you know, that we want to be surprised like that every week.
Absolutely.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the final call. All doors are now closing, and we request that you take your seats in the auditorium immediately. Final call, ladies and gentlemen, all doors are now closing. Thank you.
What you're saying there, Tomás, is that unlike, do you remember we had the few weeks ago there, the Hamlet's fantasy, and neither of us could really see a connection to the play Hamlet. You're really saying here that this one does pick up in the music, picks up very well the story of Coriolanus.
Yes, I think what I'm saying here is that Beethoven, smart man.
Smart man, absolutely. Mozart,
smart man.
Yeah. You know, I was watching Tomás, I was watching one of those YouTube recordings. Thank God for YouTube. And it was Nicholas Harnoncourt conducting the Chamber Orchestra of Europe in the Musikverein in Vienna. Magnificent hall. But I thought it was appropriate that there was the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, which is a fantastic collection of musicians. In other words, it's not, you know, the full 80, 90, 100 players. It's a trimmed down. It's much closer to what Mozart would have been writing for. Harnoncourt is just the man to do it. He's a fantastic classicist in that sense. And watching him, he he had none of these theatrical sort of demonic things. At one stage, it looked like he was just sort of gently waving to the orchestra. He was sort of massaging the air with one hand, and you could see, you could see his hand, and you could hear what it was drawing out of the orchestra. And again, we come back to something we've often touched on. You know, what does the conductor do? You know, this was a fantastic, if you could just see that 15 second clip, you'd say, that's what the conductor does, because he's not just waving his arms. You could just see he was drawing out this sound. It was magnificent.
No, I watched him conduct the 41st and the 40th and 39th. So he has a nice run of them, and he has tremendous hair.
He doesn't have much left now, I don't think.
Well, at that point in time, his hair, as he moved his head, it pulled along, you know, these magnificent locks and the tresses, exactly. And I saw, you know, the upswing of bows went along with the movement of his hair. And I thought, dear, he's providing another element to this live performance. And, of course, isn't he some kind of aristocrat?
He's descended from Holy Roman Emperors and Habsburgs and God knows what the heck else. His name, by the way, is Nicholas Harnoncourt, he's known as, but his name is Count Nicholas de La Fontaine und Darnoncourt Unversacht.
Exactly the kind of person I want conducting my Mozart.
It'd be a bit hard to fit that onto a business card. It'd sort of wrap around the back. It'd need to be double-sided or something. But again, it brought the thing back to this whole idea of viewing the orchestra as a single instrument. I think it's a multifaceted but a single unit. And it's only when you get that sort of unitary sound coming out of it and all the different things coming together that you make fullest use of the orchestral forces at your disposal. And he was doing that brilliantly in this recording.
But also, I mean, again, the pianoforte itself, that huge advance, because that's what the pianoforte is up to. That's what this instrument brought to the whole of classical music, and particularly for Beethoven. And you cannot imagine this work, and you can't imagine many of the symphonic works by Beethoven and the people who come after him, on a harpsichord. But of course, the organ is the ultimate outsourcing unit within music. And you see organs being taken up very quickly, particularly amongst the aristocracy in the 18th and 19th century, then amongst the large commercial and corporations. So you get big city things like the Belfast City Hall. They put in a big organ. I suppose even here at the concert hall, there's a very large organ there. You look at churches. One of the ways you can reduce costs is have an organ there which can perform all of the parts or perform a lot of the parts. It's a cost reduction exercise. I think there are a lot of people in the financial world who would appreciate the functions of an organ.
Ladies and gentlemen, all doors are now closing, and we request that you take your seats in the auditorium immediately. This is the final call. All doors are now closing. Thank you.